My name is Kevin Murphy, and this is the Mission Innovation Podcast.
One lady recently that finished the three-year program, she said to me, "You helped me know my baby and become the primary caregiver and primary educator of my child." And when a parent can be empowered to be that, the future of that child changes. You change the first 5 years, you change everything.
The Casey Foundation's 2018 Kids Count Data Book looks at trends in child well-being. It notes that in 2016, 1 in 5 children lived in poverty in the United States, and offers a picture of how children's health is fundamental to their overall development. Ensuring kids are born healthy is the first step towards improving their life chances. Family violence, inadequate housing, lack of preventative health care, maternal depression, poor nutrition, poverty, and substance abuse undermine children's health. Poor health in childhood affects other critical aspects of a child's life, such as school readiness and attendance, and can have lasting consequences on his or her future health and well-being. This episode of Mission Innovation speaks to two leaders in two different states impacting the health of vulnerable children. What does that impact look like? What are the stories and challenges? What are the innovations that have helped? We'll begin our conversation with Alan Sanchez.
Yes, my name is Alan Sanchez. I'm the president of CHI St. Joseph's Children in New Mexico. And we're located in 7 counties in our state. Our headquarters are in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And the goal of our community health organization is that children reach kindergarten with the health and family capacity necessary to support learning. And our strategic plan found that the greatest systemic change that we could make to accomplish our mission of CHI, of creating healthy communities, was to go upstream and address the health issues of our youngest citizens and members of our community.
Alan and Phil, can you help us understand the complexity of the type of work that you do for the community?
So we get a family referred, and the home visitor goes out to a very small New Mexico rural town, and the address is to a junkyard, literally a junkyard. And she goes into the office, and they say, "Oh, we're letting them live back there in one of these damaged pool trailers." And so she literally has to climb over, the home visitor has to climb over some hoods of cars that are on the ground and gets to the little pool trailer. And this is in November. This is cold. And here's this young family. They're both in high school. For whatever reason, they're not with their parents, the grandparents of the baby that's in the pool trailer. And this home visitor jumps into action. I mean, immediately. They're not spending another night in that little pool trailer that's in a junkyard that has the problems with windows. And making the call to the referral specialist, somebody jumps in a car, gets out there with them. We connect them to a shelter for a couple of nights, and then through Catholic Charities, connect them to some rent assistance and got them registered on SNAP and saw them through for the next few weeks. Made the whole difference. And both of them returned to high school.
I'm Phil Garopoulos. I'm the president at CHI St. Joseph Children's Health here in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. We are dedicated to improving the health of children and families in the Lancaster community. And we've gone about that by providing a combination of clinical services as well as social services in the community. When we have ventured into providing clinical services, it's been identified as gaps in care where children and families could not access or did not have the ability to access a service. So we're currently providing both behavioral health and psychiatric care, as well as dental care for children. And then we're offering health education as well as health navigation to families throughout the community. And have recently begun a community transformation initiative we call Healthy Columbia with one of the poorest boroughs in Lancaster County to try to change the health trajectory and health outcomes of that local community. And we have had a number of cases where people have reached out to us. In particular, we had a child with special needs, this autistic child who needed dental care and actually had been basically kicked out of every dental practice probably in Lancaster County who serves children. So this was an insured family of means that had a child that had a unique need. And they called us saying, "You know, would you be willing to try to see our child?" And I said, "Of course, but let's talk through what your needs are." I got the dental center manager on the phone. The child didn't do well in waiting rooms. made special arrangements for them to be the first appointment of the day, actually opened up a little bit early to be able to see this child. And we were able to successfully complete their dental care. Now, not many people get emotional about dental care, but this family had been fighting so long to just have their child's basic needs met. And because the child was viewed as difficult, were turned away time and time again. And that's the difference that our types of organizations can do in the community, is that we can rise to that challenge.
Alan, if you would, can you take us a little deeper into your program?
Yeah, I think to understand this, we understand the community first, because that's where our families are at. In New Mexico, we rank the highest in the nation for children living in poverty, and the second highest for children living in hunger. We have the highest rate of adverse child experiences in the state. So you can imagine a young family starting off, a young couple having their first baby, and the stresses that poverty has brought to them here, and the need to have assistance for the child. And so a mom who is having her first child, and we welcome people that are having their first child. So our program, the scope is first-time parents, because we think if we educate the parent the first time, then their following children will benefit from that education the parent got. So we're running the largest home visiting program in the state. But when you bring that down to one family, imagine a family earning minimum wage, doesn't pay enough to really have the roof over their head that they need, might be renting or living with parents, and probably lack medical coverage or may have not signed up for the state program. And so they come to us, they're referred through either the hospitals or schools or other social organizations. And so the outreach has gotten to them. They come to us. And the first thing in the first interview is we assess the need and make sure that the referral issues are taken care of. If there's a food insecurity, maybe we need to put them on SNAP, help them with that, teach them how to do that. Make sure if there's some kind of supplement or need for the insurance, get them on that. And then the home visitor will come to see them once a week for 3 years, and making sure that the family is being connected to the resources that exist in the state calms the family down. And that calming is important, because what we're seeing, and instead of asking somebody what's wrong with you, they're asking what happened to you. Well, in our case, we're trying to make sure it didn't happen to them, that the child isn't experiencing toxic stress that the parents are transferring over to the child. And that's where we're able to then guarantee the health of the baby. One lady recently that finished the three-year program, she said to me, "You helped me know my baby and become the primary caregiver and primary educator of my child." And when a parent can be empowered to be that, the future of that child changes. You change the first 5 years, you change everything.
So Alan, given the importance, what is your strategy for moving upstream and impacting those first 5 years?
So we operate four strategies to achieve that goal. One is home visiting. This is targeted to children from prenatal to 3 years old. So this program, we go into the home once a week for 3 years, starting prenatal, with a curriculum for health, well-being, and school readiness. Our second strategy is enhanced referral. The average family coming into our program for home visiting has approximately an average of 5 referral needs. And so if we don't address their needs or their concern or their stress, it's very hard to educate them. And so the parents can enroll from the time of pregnancy until the baby is 2 months old. This is the optimum enrollment time. Our third strategy is advocacy. We do have a trust that funds our services here, but we also advocate for all the children in New Mexico who are receiving services from other nonprofits and state agencies. And so we believe that if the funding happens for the children, then we're going to change, and we're going to also achieve our goal by working in a partnership with other organizations. And our fourth strategy is research. We are conducting with the University of New Mexico a 22-year longitudinal study following 400 children over this period of time to see the outcomes, the difference with the control group that didn't receive home visiting and a group that did.
Phil, what are the needs that your program in Lancaster, Pennsylvania are trying to address?
Sure. A lot of our families have been looking for and been unable to access appropriate care for their children. There's a lack of adequate care, certainly a lack of providers who are willing to work with lower income and our most vulnerable populations. And we've seen that in dental and behavioral health in particular in our community, where we oftentimes are the only provider available or willing to work with the family in any type of capacity. What we've tried to do is actually change that dynamic. So instead of being viewed as the only organization willing to work with them, we're seen as the best organization to be able to work with them and their family. So we build our facilities in a way that it would make any individual, whether they're uninsured and living in poverty, or if they are the wealthiest individual in Lancaster County, they would want to come and receive care at our facility. And we've actually seen that impact of adding value just by structure, not even alone talking about how we engage our patients. With our behavioral health program, what we found was that so many times the kids that were in need of behavioral health were put into a system that was addressed on fixing the child or trying to find a fix for the child and weren't looking at the environment which was surrounding the child, which was leading to and creating problems and challenges for that child. So we had families coming in and they get connected with our program, which has embedded within that a case management program, which just helps with navigating services and needs for the entire family. And we would say to the parents, you know, what do you need? How are you doing as we work with your child around the particular challenges that have presented? And multiple times we had so many families start to break down and crying, recognizing that this was the first time ever in all of the challenges they've been facing with their child that anyone has ever said to them, how can we help you be successful to be helping your child and creating an environment where your child can have the greatest success? I think that's been kind of the hallmark of all of our programs is how do we engage these families in a way that gives them and strengthens their dignity and value and supports them as they make really tough and challenging choices for the best interest of their child.
It's clear that you really see the social determinants of health and how they impact the people that you serve.
Well, you know, when we talk about that, we're talking about long-term conditions that happen to children. There's a professor named by James Heckman, if our listeners want to Google him, the Heckman equation, which shows that that brain development of a child from prenatal to 3 years old determines their health in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. The development in the brain, a very important time. In poverty, people are being exposed to toxic stress, what they call the adverse child experiences, and poverty does that. And these are the unnatural causes of bad health. And so years ago, a child, their stress was mitigated because there was more adult relationships with that baby. But today it's broken down to 1.5 adult relationships on average to an infant. And so the stress is being passed down to the child, the toxic stress. It's like a potter making a beautiful pot. In New Mexico, we have a lot of potters. I like to use that image. And that's like the brain developing in prenatal to 3 years old. And those synapses, 9,000 a second being created. And so what happens is when you experience stress, that stress interrupts. And that's the adrenaline, the hormones that are being created. They disrupt the function, the creation of a synapsis. And so it's like we're taking holes and poking it in that clay pot and wondering why then when the child arrives to school and we pour the big investment of K-12 in there, they can't hold it. Because if the child can't read at grade level at third grade, they're not going to graduate high school on time. And if they can't go to college or they can't hold a job, then the cycle of poverty continues. And so that poverty then is what keeps them in the path to bad health. So the key is very important that it's prevention is an education and experience. And even though the child might still be in poverty, you eliminated the stress and you broke that cycle.
I think it's important to notice that most parents and most families want to do well for their child. That's their goal. They want their child to thrive and be successful. I think something that we've seen is so often in healthcare, providers forget that that's kind of the core tenet that families want to do that. So when we come into a situation and a child, you know, isn't coming to their dental appointments or the parents aren't following through on referrals for additional behavioral health or support services or even basic primary care services, we like to point at the parent and say, what are you doing? Why are you being a bad parent? When in many times there are barriers in place, I think that's what we're starting to recognize with social determinants of health, that are in place that are leading to them not being able to accomplish it. It's not that they're trying to be, to use a phrase I don't like, non-compliant in their child's care, but they're trying as best they can and they need that assistance. It's where it's become so important to have patient navigators that aren't just about like getting the referral filled, but helping families figure out what the choices are, how to prioritize what needs to be done so that they can make the successful choices for their family to be able to move forward together. We've run into so many cases where even within our own program, the therapist would be saying, oh, well, we'd like to get them, you know, a home therapist or a therapeutic support staff person. We'd like to have all these other people informed of their care. And then we meet with the families on the side and we say, well, what's most important to you? What's the biggest stressor? How can we start to make progress with your child? And they reveal like, well, we're just trying to figure out how we're going to afford rent next month. And until we can figure that out, we can't really do all these things. They all sound great and we want to do it for our child, but we've got to put food on the table. We've got to get a roof over our head. And they need help figuring that out and then prioritizing the choices before them so they can make that strong choice just for their child, but also for the family as a whole. And I think that's been missing in healthcare for a long time. And it's in time that we're starting to see it incorporated both in emergency rooms and other places, in particular with chronic conditions. And what we're seeing is it's probably essential even within basic primary care to have these support systems in place so that families can be most successful.
Can you talk a bit about the types of networks that you feel are necessary to do this kind of work? So for instance, if someone said, I wanted to start a program like the one you offer in my community, how might it surprise us the types of partners that you folks have made and built to enable this kind of work?
I think partnerships are on two levels. One is an organization, but then also the families, the partnerships that we help them build. I'll quickly just mention, like Phil's talking about the referral. It's so important. We're referral with the faith. And I think Lancaster and Albuquerque both share that and are very strong and good about that. When I say, you know, referral with the faith, that we see it through and the person, if they need to go with them to offices and get this paperwork done, they do. But there's an asset building in the family. Okay, are the grandparents available to be part of this and can be relied on to support you, or neighbors or friends? And before they know it, they see there's this human asset they can help them with it. On the organization level, our partners are many, many that will surprise you, not just healthcare, not just the hospitals. We have the hospitals, we have the medical providers, but then you're looking at schools, becoming partners with the high schools, with the universities, and continuing education organizations, partnerships also with employers. They're the first ones that, because of the employee coming forward with, if they're covered by their insurance, they learn that, they then refer them to us. And with the agencies of the state and municipalities. And so the networking, it doesn't happen once, but it's a continuous visit and conversation that has to take place, that you're circling back to those partners every time. What we find out then is the community becomes a partner, that now our largest referral into our program are parents that have been through the program. And so that networking then has to be built, but then you have to continue. And so I think the primary one that we build that's important is the medical home with their pediatrician and following through with them on that. So we don't provide that medical service, but we connect them. I always say, if they're having an emergency and they call us, we failed because we didn't connect them to the resources.
Part of finding partners is really making sure that you're aligned in terms of your values. I think that's something we've really worked at is, yeah, we have built relationships with housing providers, you know, with food banks and food resources, but we want to really make sure that the partners that we're linking, the people that we serve, are consistent with the values and standards that we have in place at CHR St. Joseph Children's Health. So we don't want to be embracing someone, offering them a service that embraces their dignity and value, and then we send them to someplace who treats them poorly because of their ethnicity or because their socioeconomic status. There are certain things that are inherent to us. Like we think that healthcare is a right, so we want to make sure that they have that and that it's not impeded by their ability to pay or their insurance status. So we're trying to set them up for success when we build referrals and making sure that we know where we're sending them. So it's not just a referral that we found in the Yellow Pages or online, but it's an organization that we know that we've built a level of trust with, and that we know that our patients are going to be well received and treated with the respect that they deserve when they walk through that door.
What are the types of different kinds of questions that we need to be asking together within healthcare delivery so that the needs of poor and vulnerable are addressed better?
You know, we have to start with how we're phrasing the question. So instead of asking why people don't do things or why they haven't done things, or about how can we help you or how do you want to approach this and working in partnership, we always say with our patient navigators, our case managers, we call them the heart of St. Joseph Children's Health. But we say that they're meant to be partners walking side by side with our families on their own individual health journey. So it's not a pre-scripted relationship, but it is a genuine relationship between the case manager and the family to help them find the path together. Rather than so often, I think we're saying, well, why don't you have this in place or why didn't you do this? A good example is in Columbia Borough, where we have our Healthy Columbia Initiative. They've had an issue with children not having their immunizations at the start of the school year. And last year, they had about 10% of the kids almost thrown out of school because they didn't meet the state's immunization standards. So we start asking things from a positive level, like, okay, well, how do we approach these families? How do we offer more opportunities, more ways of engaging so that we can help eliminate this issue? When we approached many partners about it, we were raised in questions like, well, no one was actually kicked out of school. And our point was always, well, the family should never be put in a position where that threat needed to be made. They need to be reached out in a different way where it's a collaborative hand as opposed to a punitive hand that is encouraging them to make healthy choices in their lives.
Yeah, I like what you're saying, Phil, that the partnership with the family, our home visitors go in, and the curriculum isn't a specific and one way only. It's bringing options, evidence-based practices, and then looking with the family, what works best for you in your situation. And then there has to also be a cultural competency that you're helping adjust it and make it fit for the community that the people are in. Because each community will have a different need or a different way or belief. But giving them the option is where the empowerment comes. And that's what education does in changing outcomes, is that it's exposing people to other options and the growth. And so your journey in that same way, our home visitors are supervised through a process of reflective supervision instead of directive supervision. In the same way, how can you find the best options to offer to bring to this family so they're embracing what they believe will be best for their child?
It really changes healthcare's approach from transactional, which is really, you know, the traditional fee-for-service model in essence, and changing it back into that more relationship-oriented healthcare where you are building that trusting relationship with the family. There's a level of intimacy to that relationship where they're going to be willing to come to you and share what is actually going on, what the realities are in their situation, because they know you as a trusted partner and in essence a friend, as opposed to, you know, someone who's going to submit a claim to the insurance company.
And relating this back to our hospitals, then this population health management is a way for our hospital to think outside of the box, that how then can we journey with these families and persons in our community in helping them manage their health as options and have better outcomes for them in our hospitals.
We've heard this term cultural competency before, perhaps. Can you give me a sense of how that practically becomes involved in the work that you do or impacted in the work that you do?
Well, number one would be language. We have 7 different languages that our service is provided in. And if we don't have a staff member that can speak that language, well, then we have interpreters. But language, transforming health into different languages, means it has to be a competency of understanding the values of that community. So we serve 4 Native American pueblos. And going into, and each one is an independent sovereignty. So they have different culture, different language, and going to them and understanding their belief of treating the baby, especially like, for instance, I'll give you an example for the Acoma Pueblo, the touching of the head. And no stranger can touch the baby's head. And when the mother does, it's very intentional and careful because they believe, you know, with their spirit, what's happening at the time when the baby's is an infant. So these are things, okay, how do we then reach to them in the needs that the child's going to have and yet respect what they believe to be a very important either spiritual or cultural habit or practice with the child. And so you don't want to negate their beliefs. We also want to help them see the choices.
Yeah, I would echo that very much so. And in the Lancaster area, we're kind of known for refugee resettlement. We actually have the most resettlement in this area per capita, I think, across the country. We've really taken some time to both engage with the refugee resettlement organizations, but then come to them and said, not just like, how can we be of service to the individuals you are bringing to the community and welcoming to the community on our behalf, but also how can we learn about the different cultures so that when our staff are working with them, we're making appropriate suggestions. We know where culturally the answer is not going to be where we potentially need it to be. We work a lot with the Amish community here in Lancaster as well, and they don't believe in health insurance, and there are certain treatments that they do not want, whether it be in dental or in primary care. And how can you educate them? Where are the cultural pressure points where you can make change, and where do you need to be respectful of the boundaries that are in place and recognize that that is a cultural norm that we're not going to be able to impact, and we should figure out ways to improve their health around that potential challenge.
Alan and Philip, a two-part question. What are the existing barriers you are seeing to success for this kind of work? And what do you think are the systemic changes that need to occur for this work to be successful?
I think part of the challenge that we've seen is that because of the system that has been in place, where in many ways there's a two-tiered system in many ways of healthcare for the poor and vulnerable, and then the rest of the community, that many people that have access to our program haven't received care that's at the standards that is appropriate, but they haven't received care that has affirmed their value as members of the community. They've had to fight every step of the long way to try to get access for basic services for their children. So they don't really know how to respond when they call a program like ours, where the staff are welcoming, affirming of them, embracing of them, and trying to find everything that they need for their child to have the healthiest outcomes possible. So it takes some kind of embracing, retraining, some trust building for them to realize that we're not playing a game, that we're here really for their benefit, and we'll do everything and be their advocate along the way for them to be able to be successful. It's kind of sad that you're in a state within healthcare where there is kind of this dual relationship. Creating a system that is accessible to everybody and welcoming and affirming to the poor is really, I think, where we've kind of started to thrive and create an environment where we are seeing that mix. When you come into our reception areas for our patients, you see commercially insured next to Medicaid, next to uninsured, as one community and family, as opposed to, well, this is the poor clinic or this is the normal primary care office, and creating that culture where we are, again, neighbors and friends, as opposed to divided by class.
What would you point to as the best innovation or the most creative work that you've done or your colleagues have done to really serve the need in the face of very real challenges?
We've developed, to help our home visitors deliver the service, what we call subcommunities. So by a random drawing, all of our employees, doesn't matter what department they're in, they participate in a drawing, and they're placed in a subcommunity that meets once a month. And that subcommunity then talks about our core values, our mission statement, and our goals. And they come to understand who we are as an organization and who we are as persons doing this work. And that supports the home visitor who may come back to the office with some stress, because not all of our families work out in the sense of what we think to be a success. Success might also be intervening with the state agencies for child well-being, and a child is referred to be taken away from a family. Now, that's a very sad situation, but it's still a success because the child is safe. That's rare, but that's the extreme. Or a family facing an eviction and the home visitor coming back in and saying, how am I going to deal with this? Going to our referral specialist. But the innovation part I'm talking about is the support that you can give to the providers, to our home visitors, so they're able to go back into the home and support them.
Phil, any thoughts on some of the innovation or creativity that occurs with your coworkers in trying to address the needs that are there?
Well, I think that with the trust and the understanding of those, the core values and the mission and the reason why we do the work that we do, it does a couple of things. Is it generates that creativity within your team. So, I mean, we have really two different programs that I would consider at the forefront of innovation. The behavioral health program is an innovative model that actually came from the interview process with searching for a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist we ultimately hired, Dr. Tom Foley, and I began discussing, like, okay, well, if we really want to change the landscape of behavioral health, not just talk about it, but do it, what would it look like and how would we make it happen? And right there in the interview process, we began to recreate this model of family-focused behavioral health that was around changing that environment around the child. How do you motivate the changes that need to happen at the home, in the school setting, so that that child can be successful potentially without medication and definitely without hospitalization? And just in the first year, we've started to see some real results where we've gotten, you know, small percentages at this point, but about 4% of our kids, we've gotten completely off of medication. And we've seen significant reductions in dosage and number of medications that other kids are seeing. And all of those ideas are coming from presenting a really clear understanding of our goal is to improve the health of children and families, regardless of their socioeconomic status, regardless of their ability to pay. And how do we think, using the expertise around us and then the resources we have available, that we can make this happen? The other was actually listening to the community, which I think sometimes we forget to do. But I really am a firm believer that if we listen to our communities, they tell us where we need to go and they tell us how to be successful. And we started Healthy Columbia really because our board chair and our committee, who was handling the grant making we were doing in the local community, really our community benefit investments, were coming to me and saying, you know, it's nice, these grants kind of, they feel good. We're helping, you know, 10 organizations or more each year or every 6 months, but we don't feel like we're making any impact. How can we actually make a difference with this money that's a lasting difference, not just a difference for 6 months or for a year, but for years to come? And so they asked us to look at models across the country that were making major inroads. And we looked at models from Kaiser Permanente. We looked at models actually from the Democracy Collaborative and from Dignity Health, and said, how do we take these components and then create something of our own based upon what we're hearing in Columbia, which is, again, one of the poorest communities in Lancaster County, and a place where we had a presence, where we felt like we could take some of those anchor institution concepts and other ideas and implement it. And then said, okay, we're going to identify four areas that we think we need to influence if we're going to change the health trajectory of this community. And then entrusted that money to an advisory committee composed of members of the community. Now we have a voice, we're an active participant, but the board fully trusted those members of the community to say, we want to make a difference in these areas. We think with your leadership and your guidance and our trust that we can make it happen. And it's showing great results thus far, and some really innovative projects and revitalizing a town that's been struggling for decades.
Philip and Alan, if someone is out there and wants to start doing some of the type of work that you're doing, what advice would you give them? How might they start?
Well, I think for those listening, and particularly those listening who are in our system of CHI, or even if they're not in the CHI or Dignity Health system, they can experience first of what this is, the model. We're offering an international study tour twice a year. It's a 4-day event. The first one will begin September 24th. And if people want to learn more about it, they can go to our website, www.stjosephnm.org at stjosephnewmexico.org. We've created a turnkey model for a replication. It's called a replication manual. And we have now expanded outside of our state. St. Luke's in Texas, one of their hospitals, has begun this in a partnership with the county health. So this can be replicated. And I know that for Phil, there's probably many things that can be replicated in that same way, both of us welcoming people to come and visit our community health organizations.
I think a lot of it starts by asking a pretty basic question. I mean, we've been committed at Catholic Health Initiatives since our founding to creating healthier communities. And we have to start asking the question is, what does that mean? What is a healthier community? And what does a healthy community look like? And what should be included in that? And we've started to answer that to some extent. And we've started to strive towards that. So we've put our volunteer resources towards it. We've put our financial resources towards that, and trying to create and stimulate the changes that we think are necessary for our community to truly be able to say that it's a healthy community. I've started programs to make sure that no baby in the Columbia borough area will ever have to go hungry, regardless of a family's income. We've put efforts out there to make sure that no child could be lead poisoned in the borough of Columbia, which has a very high incidence of lead in their housing stock. And we've started to make sure and put efforts in place to make sure that every family has access to fresh fruits and vegetables, regardless of their income, and that they're accessible in their local community. So these are just like some of the things where, by talking to the community, by talking at and looking at the data that we have in the community, that the threats and the challenges that they're experiencing, where we started to say, okay, if our purpose is truly to create healthy communities, how do we leverage our assets and our resources and our human capital, as well as our financial capital, to make those differences happen in our community through partnership and direct service and investment, so that we have long-term success and healthy communities throughout our region?
In this episode of Mission Innovation, we heard two leaders in two different states working on initiatives impacting the health of vulnerable children. Appreciation to our guests and listeners. My name is Kevin Murphy, and this is the Mission Innovation Podcast.